This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. More and more Americans are looking to alternative medicine to treat their illnesses and to help them feel better. There are thousands of supplements and many holistic therapies from which to choose. Herbs, vitamins, acupuncture, meditation. It's now become big business, with the country spending about $34 billion a year on so-called non-traditional approaches to treatment. Well, today in Radio Times, we get two different perspectives on this trend. Paul Offit complains that these treatments are largely ineffective, potentially dangerous, and usually a waste of money. He's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, author of a new book called Do You Believe in Magic, the Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. And Paul Offit, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
On the other hand, a number of medical institutions have instituted programs that combine traditional medicine with complementary or alternative medicine, including Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia. Also joining us is Daniel Monti, director of the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine at Jeff, where he's professor in the departments of psychiatry and emergency medicine, also author of a book called The Great Life Makeover, Weight, Mood, and Sex. And Daniel Monti, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Always a pleasure.
Well, and I hate to begin with a definition because it seems like the most boring way to begin a program. Nonetheless, we're talking about things that are called alternative medicine, complementary medicine. We talk about non-traditional, traditional, Western. For you, Paul, help us understand what language you think is useful for us to use.
I think we should throw out all those terms and just say this. I mean, there's no such thing as alternative or complementary or integrative or holistic medicine at some level. There's if any of that works, then it's just good medicine. And if it doesn't work, then it's not an alternative.
Do you see good medicine, not good medicine approach?
Definitely. And the terms are problematic. Although integrative medicine, there still might be value in using that term, because when we talk about the approach to patient care, not all physicians embrace an integrative modality where we're talking about, at least from an academic institution's viewpoint of integrative medicine, lifestyle modalities, programs that support healthy living, and then selective use of complementary therapies when they make sense for an individual patient, but guided by a modern medicine approach and treatment plan.
Well, and it seems like, Paul, your definition, if I could use that word, is that the treatments that seem to be effective from your perspective have been tested rigorously using, you know, double-blind studies, that kind of thing, to show some kind of result.
Sure, but I actually agree with Dr. Monti. I mean, I think that as conventional therapists, technically, we're not very good about doing things like stress reduction, for example. And I mean, Dr. Monti is actually a leader in his field in looking at what are those mediators of stress reduction, which can do things like affect the immune system positively or negatively. That's important research, and that to me is all medicine. And, mm-hmm. and I think when Dr. Monti says that we should make sure that we integrate that into what we do, I think he's exactly right.
You, though, do begin your book with a series of incidents you had where you felt like you didn't get the kind of care that you were looking for. And I think, you know, we've all had some version of that experience. It seems like you tell that story to say that there are frustrations people have with our, quote-unquote, traditional healthcare system.
Definitely. I mean, and I think I've experienced a number of them. And so I think that one should be skeptical of conventional medicine. But I think when one is frustrated with conventional medicine, that doesn't therefore mean that alternative, what we call alternative mm-hmm. therapy, should be given a free pass. I think we should bring that same skepticism to that side as well, instead of it living often as it does under this kind of untouchable halo of goodwill. I think it's very easy to get duped when you have that attitude.
What's an example of quackery?
So there certainly are physicians out there who will medicine fails. So, for example, there's not a clear cause or cure for autism. There are certain cancers that are impossible to treat, at least with current therapies. And there often are charlatans who are perfectly willing to step up in that situation and willing to make a fortune off of patients' misfortunes by saying, this is what the doctor doesn't want you to know. This is what the pharmaceutical company doesn't want you to know. But we know, and here's how we can treat mm-hmm. this. And, you know, people get ripped off.
Like Laetril? I mean, I don't know. That's almost ancient history now, but is that an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, wish it was ancient
history.
It's you
not
can
ancient?
Still get Laetril off the internet. No, you're right. That's a perfect example. That became really a social movement, Laetril. It was a freedom of choice movement. And to some extent, you see that in the dietary supplement industry today. It's, you know, it's what, you know, what we're going to do, even though conventional therapists don't want us to do it. But again, it always comes down, as Dr. Monte said, to good medicine. Mm-hmm. Or do the data support the contention?
How do you deal with the charlatans in the health medicine business?
Yeah, I think that Dr. Offit makes an excellent point that we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we need to make a distinction between a modality that might support a patient during their treatment process versus making a claim that it's going to cure the disease. So, for example, we have a very well-run acupuncture program that the oncology specialists at Jefferson often refer to for supportive care. There's been good prospective data, for example, that acupuncture might be preventive for radiation-induced xerostomia, painful sores in the mouth from radiation treatment. And sometimes patients don't do well with pain medication who are getting cancer treatments and have cancer-related pain. And acupuncture might have a role, and many patients feel that it helps them. However, to say that the acupuncture is going to cure their cancer, that's problematic.
You, though, write in your book, and I'm not trying to start a fight here, but you write, Paul, acupuncture is a deception.
By definition. I mean, so acupuncture, it's an interesting story, acupuncture. It's born of 2nd century BC China. This is a culture that not only didn't believe in dissection, but punished anyone who dissected a human body with death, which was a tremendous disincentive. So what did the Chinese believe? They believed that the body was divided up into 365 different parts because there are 365 days of the year. They believed that there were these meridians, these longitudinal arcs from head to toe into which one inserted needles. Why 12 meridians? Because there are 12 great rivers in China. So if you believe that the human anatomy isn't based on days of the year, mm-hmm. rivers in China, then they were making it up. And there have been studies done looking at people who benefit from acupuncture, who clearly benefit from acupuncture, to try and answer the question, does it matter where you put the needles? Even to some extent, recent studies, does it even matter whether you put the needles under the skin? Now, that's not to say that it doesn't work. I think for some people, they do experience, for example, pain relief. And so to me, it's what is it about that interaction? Is it they're lying down? Is it that there's nice music? Is that there's incense burning? Is it they feel the touch of the clinician or the needle? What is it about that interaction that is mm-hmm. therapeutic? And I think those who practice acupuncture actually owe it to the medical community to determine that.
Do you know the answer to that?
Nobody definitively knows the answer to why acupuncture works, why lots of things work, even why several pharmaceuticals work. But I think that there's more answers to why acupuncture works. There have, in the last couple of years, been functional neuroimaging studies that show that when people get acupuncture according to the points versus sham acupuncture, that while initially people seem to benefit, the placebo effect versus something else going on has been distinguished in some studies. Now, certainly more work needs to be done, but there is some compelling data that says maybe we need to look at this more, and maybe there's more to the story than just a placebo effect, because different areas of the brain light up that more correspond to pain areas versus emotional areas that you would expect from a placebo response. So while nobody can answer the question of exactly how it works, and the theory certainly might be flawed, there might be something that we still need to uncover.
Well, you write a lot about the placebo effect in this book, Paul.
Yeah, wish we had a different word. I mean, I think when people hear the word placebo, they think of it as dismissive, that you're just saying it's all in my head and that it's not real. I think that's not true, as mm-hmm. Dr. Monte, I think, alludes to. There are people who benefit from the placebo where there is a physiological response. I mean, you can learn to release your own endorphins. You can learn to upregulate and downregulate your own immune system. There's studies showing you can learn to release your own dopamine. There's whole books written on the placebo response that is a real physiological phenomenon. And I think we, as certainly conventional mm-hmm. healers, aren't necessarily great at studying this. And I'm glad people like Dr. Monte are.
But I mean, it seems in certain ways a placebo effect could be on a belief system. I mean, if you believe that something is going to help you feel better, then maybe it does help you feel better.
I think I'll give you a perfect story. I mean, my daughter is 18. She rode crew. She gets tingling in her hands sometimes. And she wanted to get she thought she had exercise-induced asthma, which she doesn't. She wanted a bronchodilator, which she wasn't going to get. So my wife took her to the General Nutrition Center and bought her Himalayan sea salt puffer. Right. So it's just plastic canister. Holes in the top, you put the sea salt on the bottom, so you breathe in salt air. She's reading the label the next day. She thinks this is great, right? Himalayan mountains, hundreds of millions of years old. This is going to be great. So I said to her, honey, do you really think that the sodium chloride in this is any different than the sodium chloride in that salt shaker? And she looks at me and she says, would you let me believe in something, damn it? And I think she's right.
Do you think she's right? I mean, is it about belief? And, well, yeah, go ahead, because I have another question for you. But do you think it's about, I mean, is it belief? And should we discredit that?
Belief plays a role in the healing process, whether we're talking about a conventional therapy or an alternative therapy. Our expectation plays a role in what the outcome is going to be of many medical therapies. And in almost every pharmaceutical study, when there's a an inactive agent given as the control group, there very often is a high response initially that over time washes out. So our sense that we're being treated for something does play a role, whether we're talking about a conventional treatment or an alternative treatment.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, there's an interesting study published in the New England Journal of Medicine where people with asthma were given acupuncture, sham acupuncture, a real bronchodilator, albuterol, or a sham bronchodilator. And what was interesting about that study, and this gets a little bit to what Dr. Monti said, the people who received the real bronchodilator clearly benefited in a lung function test, an objective lung function test. The other three groups believed they had benefited, and actually the four groups weren't distinguished actually in how they thought they had done, even though actually one had really truly benefited as was measured. So believing that you were better doesn't necessarily correlate with actually being better, which is an interesting study.
Well, indeed. But I'm curious about, I mean, is it possible to take acupuncture about a minute before our first break here, but to take acupuncture and do the sort of double blind studies that are done on different kinds of treatments?
There have been those studies, and there have been mixed results in various different problems. There have been Parkinson's studies, some that have been very compelling, some that said, I don't think this shows very much. And then I think the study I was alluding to before showed a distinction, actually, with sham versus the actual acupuncture points in how the brain responded to the acupuncture. So I think there's more to learn about acupuncture and that there's enough data to warrant to keep looking at it.
And we're almost up in a break here, Paul, but I'm assuming you would agree that it's important to test this stuff as much as we possibly can.
Sure, but I think where you need to make sure you don't get into trouble is that if Steve Jobs being a perfect example of that, here was a man who had a treatable cancer but chose acupuncture as part of his therapy instead, and that choice actually ended up causing him to lose his life.
And that's Paul Offit. He's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, author of a new book called Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Also with us is Daniel Monti, and he's the director of the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia, where he heads up is a professor in the departments of psychiatry and emergency medicine. Wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Great Life Makeover, Weight, Mood, and Sex. We'll be talking about dietary and supplements after this very short break. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
This week in This American Life, a dozen little boys crowd into a pitch-black bathroom.
Turn out the lights! Go! Let's get scared!
Bloody Mary! Bloody
little boys chant to make a bloody face appear in a mirror. Also, camp dances, fake Indian powwow, singing in the mess hall, color wars.
Bloody Mary, stop!
Crap,
If you didn't go to summer camp this summer, come with us this week on This American Life from Public Radio International.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, enough about the royal baby. Let's talk about his great-grandmother. Queen Elizabeth was a teen during World War II when she spoke to other children on the BBC.
I feel that I am speaking to friends and companions who have shared with my sister and myself many a happy children's hour.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are, for the lack of a better word, talking about the pros and cons of alternative or complementary medicine. And again, our guests are Drs. Daniel Monti and Paul Offit, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me go back to you, Paul, and also back to your book. You say, and it's true, that the FDA does not regulate, for the most part, the 50,000 substances, I guess, that fall under supplements or dietary supplements?
Right. Since 1994, with the passage of the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, the FDA really doesn't have the capacity to regulate whether to make these companies prove that their products are safe or prove that their products are effective. Since 2007, in theory, they have the capacity to look at manufacturing and the label, but really they haven't effectively done that. And so they're always in a reactive mode. It's always when things get really bad, that's when the FDA gets involved and starts pulling things off the market, most recently these diabetes drugs. But I think the consumer is not well served here. You want these companies to be able to actually support their claims and admit their harms. And the way it's currently structured, that's not true.
But if you look at the label there, maybe even the small print, does it say, you know, this is not approved by the FDA?
Yeah, you have to. So the way it works is that there's this sort of wink and nod claim, which is, you know, supports heart health, supports joint health, supports prostate health. And then there's the last risk. And if you look on the bottom, hopefully with a magnifying glass so you can actually read it, it says the FDA has not approved this product for the treatment, prevention, or a diagnosis of any disease. So it's there, but I think that's certainly not what people perceive it to be. If you go into a GNC center and you ask, you know, do you have something that can help shrink my prostate, you know, you'll be pointed to something, even though in all likelihood it doesn't do that at all.
And what might you be pointed to? And then we'll go to you.
You'll be pointed to Saul Palmetto. I mean, I know this. I was actually went into a GNC center last week and asked that question, and the young man standing behind the counter said, you want Saul Palmetto. Now, there are a couple studies that have been done, and excellent studies, and one in the New England Journal, the other one in Journal of the American Medical Association, showing that Saul Palmetto does not shrink your prostate. Now, you can argue that label doesn't claim that it does, but it is the wink and nod, and there are drugs which can help, you know, relax the muscles of the prostate, shrink the prostate, like Avodart or Flomax. And so, and you know, prostatic hypertrophy, which is, say, enlarged prostate, is not a trivial thing. You can have kidney stones, you can have bladder disease, you can have kidney disease. You shouldn't fool around with it. And this would be an example of fooling around with it.
Do you think supplements should be better labeled and better researched?
This is a complicated issue.
It is.
And I think things have gotten better since 2007. And actually, the FDA could exercise more of what it could do since 2007. On the other hand, again, we want to know, we have to be careful about where we draw the line on this issue, because there are supplements that are safe and that are helpful and have been well studied. There's been formulations of vitamins and nutrients that have been shown to help slow the progress of macular degeneration in studies. And if as long as the product label isn't making claims beyond what it should and it actually has the ingredients in it that it's supposed to have in it, and I know that has been a problem in the past, then these should be available to people. You know, likewise, you know, I take magnesium every day in a larger amount than would be in a multivitamin, because they've been shown, it's been shown in studies, to be protective against migraines, and indeed that works for me and many of our patients. And so I think that we have to be, you know, thoughtful about this issue. We want to not have the public be misled. We want to we certainly want safety for patients and for the public. And on the other hand, we don't want to block availability of every supplement that's out there when there is a relative amount of safety data.
And Paul, just going quickly back to you, you do say though that omega-3 fatty acids has some benefit folic acid, good in pregnancy. And I think you also talk about calcium and vitamin D for osteoporosis.
Yeah, there's some data. Certainly folic acid is clear, but I think the public is being misled. I mean, if you look, for example, at the studies looking at megavitamins, and by megavitamins I mean taking vitamins in quantities fivefold, 10 times, 20 times the recommended daily allowance, there is pretty good evidence that that increases your risk of cancer, increases your risk of heart disease, and might shorten your life. I don't think the public knows about this, and it's called in the medical literature the antioxidant paradox. And I just find that because the industry is essentially unregulated, they are under this. These companies are under no obligation to admit their harms. That if you go into a general nutrition center and you buy natural vitamin E, you can look on the back and find that it's 3,333% of the recommended daily allowance. That means it's 33 times the recommended daily allowance. Almonds are a good source of vitamin E. To get that quantity of vitamin E, you would need to eat roughly 1,700 almonds. That's not a natural thing to do. So you sort of bypass the body's satiety system, which is to say, you know, you're not going to normally eat 1,700 almonds. It amazes me that this industry is able to convince people that everything is all natural and safe when, in fact, there are harms.
Do you agree? Even using that example?
Yes. I agree that megadoses of certain vitamins, particularly the non-water soluble vitamins, can be hazardous and can increase the risk of cancer. On the other hand, we also have to be thoughtful and balanced that not enough nutrients can also increase the risk of cancer. And vulnerable populations sometimes need to be fortified or supplemented with vitamins and nutrients. And so I just want the perspective to be balanced. We don't want to mislead the public. We want to make sure that the public has the right information. But at the same time, we don't want to limit availability of every nutrient when actually there's relatively good safety data. And taking a regular multivitamin might actually decrease your risk of cancer.
But how would you know? I mean, how would you know how much is too much?
Well, how much is there are guidelines set by the USRDA, and we don't want mega doses of non-water soluble vitamins because our body doesn't deal well with them. However, something that's within the relative guidelines of those standards can be helpful and can be protective, and that was most recently shown in December 2012 in the Journal of the American Medical Association. There was a study, a men physicians health study, that showed that there was a long-term modest but statistically significant protective effect of taking a multivitamin every day.
Go ahead, Paul.
We're agreeing. I mean, I'm not saying anything about multivitamins. I think probably most people don't need them. It makes for probably a fair amount of expensive urine, but I don't think that hurts, and it may arguably help. The we're talking about megavitamins. So if we're both agreeing that these large quantities of vitamins like vitamin A or E or beta carotene, a precursor, can hurt you, I would argue most people in the public don't know that. If you certainly buy that product that I told you about, that sort of megavitamin E, it's nowhere on the label. I mean, you have to look very hard to find it. And I think the industry knows this. I think their attitude is, let's just market it away. People are much more likely to watch our commercial on television than they are to read the New England Journal of Medicine. We can get away with this. And they have been getting away with it for years.
Well, if you also watch television, you see a lot of ads for pharmaceuticals that have been, you know, approved by the FDA, promising all sorts of things. Yes, they do give you the warnings at the very end, which sometimes are just hilarious when you compare them to the lovely images of people frolicking in fields. I think you know what I'm talking about here. I mean, these ads can be misinterpreted by an uninformed member of the public as well.
If you're arguing that pharmaceutical companies make products that often can have just marginal efficacy and that they sort of push them upon us where we may not need them, I completely agree with that. But that doesn't therefore mean that these alternative therapies should be given a free pass. I mean, if I told you that a vaccine or a drug dramatically increased your risk of cancer, you'd like to know about that. And when the industry is regulated, as it is, for example, on the pharmaceutical companies, when Vioxx was found to double your risk of heart attack if used for 18 months at a certain dose, you knew that because the FDA regulated it. They put out media advisors, and Vioxx became very quickly synonymous with the word poison. I would argue that these megavitamins are in that category, and yet we don't know about it because the industry isn't regulated. There was there was an article actually in the Wall Street Journal a few months ago titled, "Is This the End of Popping Vitamins?" And it was because there had been two studies, both done in the same month, that showed that it increased your risk of cancer and heart disease. And there was a quote in there by the CEO of I think one of JNC Corporation that said, "We just ignore these studies. We let them pass. It doesn't have any effect on our business." And I think that's right. It doesn't have any effect on their business, but it should. We should be a more informed consumer.
And that's Paul Offit, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, author of a new book called Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Daniel Monti also with us, Director of the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center for Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you want to just say something in response to what Paul said, and then we'll get to our callers?
Yeah. I actually agree with Dr. Offit that when we know that a mega dose of something can be harmful, it should be on the label.
And in big letters.
Letters. The issue is that there are so many harmful things on even over-the-counter drugs, and there you can't fit everything in big letters. And a study just came out in the last week showing that, you know, women taking decongestants during pregnancy, there's an increased risk of birth defects. And, you know, I don't know where they're going to fit that on the label of the long list of problems that there already are on so many over-the-counter things. And so, you know, in whatever letters that the FDA, you know, has for the rest of the pharmaceutical industry, you know, that's not my expertise. Mm-hmm. But I think that part of the problem is that even if these things end up on the labels, I don't know how much they're going to influence people's behaviors, because they don't seem to influence people's behaviors that much when it comes to the pharmaceuticals.
Very quickly,
yeah,
Bob.
I think it did influence people's behavior regarding Vioxx. I mean, because the FDA regulated that industry, you very quickly knew that was a problem. I mean, I think if the FDA regulated this industry, which they haven't, the mega vitamin industry, frankly, since the mid-1970s, I think if you had media advisories that were put out massively by the FDA, you would know about it. So I think it is possible.
Mm. Let me see what Kit from Bucks County has to say. Kit, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you all? I think integrative medicine is a very different issue from talking about people self-treating, which is, of course, a huge problem with either any type of product that's on the market. My experience with integrative medicine has been profound. I mean, as I work for a big company, and they provide a health assessment for their employees, and as I got up into my 40s, I saw my numbers starting to creep up, my cardiac numbers, and that bothered me. So I did a lot of research, and I made the decision to work with an integrative physician outside Philadelphia. And 12 months later, when I had my health assessment again, the counselor from my company called and said, either you had a 30-year-old go take your blood work, or you're doing something pretty dramatic, and we'd like to know what you're doing. That was the dramatic change in me, just from going to an integrative doctor that can wear either hat. I have tremendous respect for the health care that we have in our country for acutely ill people who have been injured in some way. You need, you know, the medical care, the surgical care. But what we don't do well enough is we don't put the same energy into prevention. And when you find out as you're aging or you're under stress and different levels of things are falling and dropping, Dr. Monti mentioned the magnesium deficiency.
Well, you know what, Kit?
Sorry.
No, that's okay. Only just because I'm watching the clock. We got a lot of callers on. You raised some really interesting points, which I want to toss to Daniel Monti, where she's talking about, you know, I think what you both are talking about, which is using as much good medicine as you possibly can.
Right. And I think we both agree on that. I think integrative medicine, the way we define it in an academic sense, prevention is very important. And some of those lifestyle interventions that her integrative physician likely helped her engage with, such as stress reduction, a healthy diet, because as a nation, we don't eat a healthy diet for the most part. In fact, we have the best medicine in the world, by many standards, but we don't have the healthiest population in the world. In fact, we don't make the top 10 list for healthy life expectancy for men or for women. And some of the countries that do really have an integrated model where natural approaches to health along with good modern medicine are done collaboratively together as part of the healthcare system. And I think that that's what this woman benefited from.
Yeah, I mean, is that a model you would support?
Sure. I think the kind of work that people like Dr. Mani do is really important. I mean, try and, you know, put in, you know, good lifestyle changes, understand ways to reduce stress. What are the moderators of that reduction? I think that's really important work. I think it's great.
Kid, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You go after Jenny McCarthy, who you have gone after in previous books and on this program talking about vaccines and autism. You also include Suzanne Summers as people that are promoting some of these products. Why should anyone believe anything they say anyway? I mean, why go after them?
Well, the answer to your first part of your question is why believe them beats me. I guess we believe we know celebrities and we trust them. We see them on the big screen or the little screen, and that makes us believe that we know them. They're an attractive face for the industry. You could argue that in a more rational world that we would be more likely to listen to people who have expertise and experience in the subject, not a celebrity. But, you know, that's always worked. I mean, that's why companies put people like Jenny McCarthy or Suzanne right. Summers up to promote them.
And are you troubled by that, Daniel?
Celebrities aren't healthcare experts.
No,
they're not. And the problem is there's often misinformation. And sometimes where there's helpful information, it gets diluted by misinformation. So, you know, for just, you know, one example, you know, one of those celebrities talks about bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, which actually hormone replacement therapy has had a difficult course since the WHI study over the right. past 11 years or so. And we went from, you know, giving everybody HRT to nobody getting HRT. And, you know, studies have shown, and there was just one in the last 2 weeks out of Yale, that you know, we could have prevented maybe 50,000 deaths in women if we would have actually repleted estrogen in women who had their uterus removed. The pendulum swung too far to the other side, and estrogen is actually important for women as they age for lots of reasons.
Well, you know, this I think is a frustration I know I have, and I don't think it doesn't matter what kind of medicine we're talking about, Paul, but some, you know, you read a headline, there's a new study that says this is good for you, then 2 years later you find out it's bad for you. It seems like there's a lot of, I'm not saying it's misinformation, but changing information. And it's hard to be an informed consumer when it seems like, you know, a study can knock out a previous study and all of a sudden what you thought was good is now bad.
Right. I think in the media, the media isn't great about this. I think when a study comes out, it always is viewed as a definitive thing. That's not true. You know, I think science stands on two pillars. One is peer review, but the more important one is the second one, which is reproducibility. I mean, I think truths do eventually emerge over time, and I think we should wait for those studies to be reproduced. I mean, if you look at in the vaccine world, you know, Andrew Wakefield publishes a study, which really wasn't a study at all, you know, claiming that MMR vaccine caused autism. That was wrong. Study after study showed that was wrong, but the media jumped all over that study. It did a lot of harm.
Right. But the, I mean, what you're talking about is peer reviewing what everything that's used as a form of treatment and having some kind of reproducible results when it comes to that?
Right. I'm saying if you have a hypothesis, if you believe, for example, that concentrated garlic lowers low-density lipoprotein cholesterol, beta cholesterol, you would like to see study after study done by different groups on different populations of people showing that that's true. And I think then one can say that truth emerges. I mean, you know, I think when you're right. I mean, people see one study say one thing and one study another, and people will say that, well, see, you can't study. You can't trust scientists, or you can't trust science. You can trust science. That's why you can trust science, because it is mutable, because it is willing to throw a textbook over your shoulder without a backward glance as we generate more information. It's self-correcting, and ultimately truths do emerge, but it requires some patience.
Let's hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. And that's Paul Offit, our guest today on Radio Times, author of a new book called Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. Also with us, Daniel Monti, director of the Jefferson Myrna Brin Center of Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University here in Philadelphia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Folk Festival proudly supports WHYY. This year's festival presents the Richard Thompson Electric Trio, Todd Rundgren, the David Bromberg Quintet, The Mavericks, Asleep at the Wheel, The Carolina Chocolate Drops, and many more. For a weekend of concerts, crafts, kids' activities, and camping, the Philadelphia Folk Festival, August 15th through 18th on the Old Pool Farm in Upper Salford. For tickets and festival information, 800-556-FOLK or folkfest.org.
On the next Fresh Air, the famine, vengeance killings, rape, and deportations throughout Europe just after World War II. We talk with Keith Lowe about his book, Savage Continent, which has just been published in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
As whistleblower saboteur Edward Snowden seeded the clouds for a new Cold War between the U.S., Russia, and China.
We believe that Snowden had broken the law in the United States and should be put up for extradition so he could face charges. So they did fail the test.
Outgoing U.S. Ambassador to Hong Kong Stephen Young on China going backwards. Where's Russia headed? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Alternative medicine used to be just popular with the counterculture types, but now it looks as many as half of the American population has used some form of non-traditional treatment, whether it's an herbal supplement or acupuncture or holistic therapies. It's about a $30-plus billion-a-year industry. We are talking about some of the pros and cons of alternative or complementary medicine with Paul Offit and Daniel Monti, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Danny, you wanted to talk about sort of the testing of some of these more alternative treatments.
Yeah, I mean, Dr. Offit is absolutely correct. We need to test everything as much as possible. There's a reality that we can't test everything and that we don't test everything, even in conventional medicine, and that really 20 to 30% of prescriptions written every day have not gone, are for off-label uses of a medication that haven't gone through that type of rigorous testing where there's anecdotal data or there's a hypothesis that that medication could work for this condition and we just don't have anything better. And sometimes it makes sense to use some of these complementary modalities for that same condition where we just don't have anything better because there is some anecdotal data that needs further investigation, just like the drugs need further investigation. And then there's things that where there really is a preponderance of evidence based upon, you know, when you kind of pool together a lot of different data sources. And, you know, we were talking about estrogen just a few minutes back, and I think that that's why so many researchers have arrived at the fact that estrogen replacement and perhaps testosterone replacement in people as they age makes sense for a lot of subgroups. Not for everybody, but for a lot of subgroups.
Paul, I think I saw you nodding a little bit when Daniel was talking about the off-label use of some of these drugs.
Sure. I work in a pediatric hospital, a Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. A strikingly high percentage of the drugs in our formula often haven't been tested extensively in children. So, you know, we're left trying to figure out best dosing. We're left trying to figure out the best way to give the drug. I think that's true. And I think my response to that is that I think we should demand that. I mean, we should demand of the FDA that for example, in our case, and taking care of children, that these data be generated so that we can make the best decision for our children, that we shouldn't just allow this to happen, which I think we do at some level.
Let me see what looks like Danielle from Chester County has to say. Danielle, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Hi, I'm actually from the city of Chester, but lucky enough to be an oncology patient at Jefferson, and I've had such stellar care from surgeons and medical oncs, radiation, and I've gone through chemo, and I was thrilled, frankly, when I found out about the Myrna Bryn Center, but then hugely dismayed because I kind of wanted to throw everything at my gyn cancer diagnosis, and when I got the intake paper and looked at it, it's $300 to walk in the door. So my concern is access to people who know what they're doing, who can be on the same page and have the importance, familiarity with the effects of radiation, chemo drugs, et cetera. So I would have loved to have taken advantage of it, but it was completely cost prohibitive. So if someone could address that.
Sure.
I mean, and I was lucky enough, my friends put together a package and I benefited from massage, which I still do, and I'm doing great. But like I said, so to match the incredible meticulous care that I've gotten from other doctors at Jefferson, it was horrible to find out. So I don't know who can it.
Oh, I know. I know exactly who can do it. Because we have Daniel Monti, the director of the Jefferson Myrna Brind Center for Integrative Medicine. Go ahead.
Thank you for that call, because this is a huge problem, access, because insurance companies don't really reimburse physicians to sit with a patient for an hour or an hour and a half like the physician you would have seen on intake. And so that leaves either patients paying for it or having philanthropic funds. And I wish you would have actually called when you got your packet, because whenever anybody from the Jefferson Kimmel Cancer Center refers a patient to us, if the patient can't afford it, we have a philanthropic fund for cancer patients so that we help them out and they can get the care mm-hmm. that they need. And that's how I've dealt with the fact that it really was problematic for me that we weren't getting reimbursement for some of these things. There are certain types of things we do get insurance reimbursement for, but be clear, at the end of the day, I oversee our finances. We do not make the bottom line from patient care revenues. We make our bottom line patient care revenues, our research projects, and then a little bit of philanthropic support. So when you do integrative medicine the way we do, and we're not selling gimmicks, and we're really trying to do comprehensive whole patient care, body, mind, and spirit, it isn't a big money maker, and it is difficult to figure out where to get the money, and sometimes the patients have to contribute.
Danielle, thanks for the call to Radio Times. She mentioned massage. I'm curious about chiropractic massage, even yoga. I mean, do you think there's a way to do the kind of research that you want done on some of these alternative treatments?
Sure. I mean, I think of the three things you mentioned, I mean, massage and yoga, I suspect people relax with that. I think that they probably, that there's a decrease in stress mediators, and that's all studyable. I put chiropractic in a different category. I mean, chiropractic was born in the late 1800s of the notion, the incorrect notion, that all diseases are associated with misaligned spinal columns. That's not true. I mean, diabetes, for example, is caused by a pancreas's inability to secrete insulin. It has nothing to do with the manipulating your spinal column. So I think when chiropractors leave sort of the musculoskeletal system and enter into these areas of medicine based on this false belief that diseases are caused by misaligned spinal columns, I think they can do harm and have.
Do you agree?
I think just like the field of medicine had a lot of incorrect notions early on, so can be said of many other fields. And I think like the field of medicine, chiropractic has evolved a lot over the last several decades, and there's been a big change in the training, the regulation, the licensure of chiropractors. And I think that's why we've seen some positive studies, like for low back pain relief and things like that. And I agree with Dr. Offit that when anybody goes way outside the scope of what they are trained to do and what they're licensed to do, it can be a problem. But I think that, like many fields, chiropractic has evolved from some of those earlier roots.
Going back to your book, Paul, I mean, it seems you are also making an argument that we need to understand this placebo effect much better and perhaps even use it more effectively to help people feel better.
Definitely.
Did I read that right?
Yeah, I'll give you an example. I mean, I had microfracture surgery on my knee a few years ago, and when I saw my surgeon, a Penn surgeon, sports medicine surgeon, in my recovery period, he said, you should take chondroitin sulfate and glucosamine. That's what he said. Now, he said, because this is going to help collagen deposition in your knee, and this is going to help decrease inflammation. So that surprised me. I certainly never heard about this in medical school. And when I went to look to see whether there was any data on this, if anything, the data were on the other side, that it didn't seem to be any better than placebo. But that didn't mean that it couldn't have worked as a placebo. In other words, if I had taken that, if I hadn't bothered to look and have just sort of believed this on its face and had taken this and believed that I was getting better, and that caused me to avoid taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, which certainly have side effects, or COX-2 inhibitors like Celebrex, which certainly can have side effects, if that meant that I could have avoided that, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing, even though it wasn't based on anything, frankly, physiological.
But maybe based on a relationship that you have with your doctor or just, you know, wanting to believe that, that something is going to make you feel better?
Sure, we all do that. I mean, I think when people come into Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, we there is a therapy that is expected. We have long white coats. We have red stenciling. We have interesting big machines that make interesting noises. I think there's an expectation of healing, and that's a big part of healing. I think that's all true.
And go ahead, Dan, and then we'll get back to our conversation.
I think we need to investigate things that have a scientific plausibility. And when, you know, when they don't, we need to recognize that there's not a scientific plausibility. But a good example of plausibility would be something that, you know, we're looking at, and that's the old vitamin C story. So there was this huge debate in the oncological literature in the late 70s into the early 80s that was spurred by Linus Pauling. Dr. Offit does a nice chronicle of some of the issues related to that. And the issue was put to rest largely because oral vitamin C in a large mega dose is probably just going to hurt your stomach and cause other GI problems, and it isn't going to help your cancer. However, the NIH in the last couple of decades stumbled serendipitously across the fact that vitamin C, when given as a drug, pharmaceutically, at high doses infused through a mechanism that wasn't talked about back then, actually kills cancer cells in both in vitro and animal models. And they got that to the point that it was worth investigating again, reopening it up, now with scientific plausibility, giving it a completely different way. You can't take it orally. It's not going to work, but it has to be infused as a drug. And so now, you know, with an IND from the FDA and IRB approval, we actually are doing those clinical trials at Jefferson at the Myrna Brin Center and published the first phase one study with pancreatic cancer and what it does to tumors and looking at the phase two and looking at other cancer types because there's a rationale for doing it. The problem is that sometimes the rationale for why even people take a certain substance, it isn't there, and that's problematic. So if people got some relief from glucosamine, whether it be from placebo or some other mechanism, deposition of collagen never really made sense.
What do you think? And you do write about vitamin C and Linus Pauling, and you criticize him for not, I guess, admitting that he was wrong when it came to vitamin C as he understood it or was promoting it.
Yeah, I think that it was odd. I mean, here was a brilliant man. He was the only person ever to win two unshared Nobel Prizes. He was a rigorous thinker, and yet something happened when he hit his mid-60s where he was unable to admit he was wrong when he clearly was wrong. I mean, I think you know, that first I'll be interested to hear what or see what Dr. Amanti finds when he gets to his phase three part of his trial. But I think the big take-home message here for me is first, do no harm. I mean, don't do something that's going to hurt you. And I think that alternative medicine sometimes lives under this untouchable halo of goodwill. We assume it's all natural, it's all good, it can only be a positive benefit and therefore can't hurt you. And that's never true. If something has a positive effect, it can certainly have a negative effect. It's true of any medicine or drug. And these dietary supplements are drugs. So be careful.
Let me get, looks like Bob from Mercer County to join us on Radio Times. And Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to ask your guests, what exactly is a good result from a treatment? If a treatment extends your life 2 months, is that a good result? Is that worth it? Or, well, I'd throw that out.
Well, that's a big, big question, Bob, because you know, every person is different. Every situation is different. But this, I'm assuming, is physicians, you have to deal with this. Go ahead, Dan.
It's something that we all have to deal with. And it's a great question because it depends upon how that treatment might impair or enhance your quality of life over those 2 months, rather. This is something that oncologists have to deal with every day. There are certain drugs that have gotten FDA approval, and the Meyer-Kaplan curves, the benefit is something like 2 weeks to 2 months. And that has to be weighed against what is the toxicity of the drug, how is that going to impair your quality of life, or is it something that might even help your quality of life over those 2 weeks to 2 months. And that has to all be taken into account when you make the decision.
Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Paul, we talk about patient autonomy. I'm assuming that physicians, medical people want patients to feel that they have some degree of autonomy, but that can be someone like a Steve Jobs who had a curable cancer but chose to treat it in non-traditional ways. How do you deal with that?
It's hard. I mean, obviously, patients are only going to be compliant with their therapies if they understand them and buy into it. So you want the patient to have buy-in. On the other hand, it's a fine balance between that and sort of ceding your expertise. I mean, you, in theory, the physician is the one who has the experience and expertise. And so when you're saying, look, you need to make this decision, at some level, then you have to be comfortable with them making a bad decision that can be quite harmful. I mean, Steve Jobs made a terrible decision that ultimately ended up costing him his life. I'm not sure to what extent he saw doctors in those first few months, but I know that his friends, at least according to the Walter Isaacson book, were urging him to choose, conventional medical care. But here's a guy whose success in many ways was due to the fact that he broke the mold. He never had focus groups. He trusted his own opinion. And unfortunately, he should have stuck to sort of the graphics that he was so good at and not medicine, because medicine he obviously didn't know.
Right. And he made the choice. And I mean, I'm not saying that he... Who knows what would have happened if he'd chosen something else. But it is interesting to think about patient autonomy and what people can be misled, obviously, and people can have good, smart information.
It's exactly the reason that we have and need more academically based integrative medicine centers that train physicians, that provide medical student teaching and training like we do, because Steve Jobs would have had a different outcome if he would have come to a place like the Myrna Bryn Center if he was interested in integrative therapies, because he would have immediately been referred for co-management or primary management from our oncological team at Jefferson or whatever institution he wanted to go to, Penn or the main line, and we would have worked collaboratively to support his overall treatment plan, but his primary treatment would have been in the medical model.
But, you know, and part of all this, Paul, and to both of you, is just, I mean, we have such a complicated healthcare system anyway, and I know a lot of physicians feel like they're, especially those on the front line, they don't have time to really talk to their patients and find out what's going on with them and to deal with some of the stressors that we've been talking about.
It's a weakness. It's a weakness of the conventional medicine system. And I think alternative healers, I think, at some level offer something that the conventional healer doesn't, in that they do spend more time, are more attentive to these lifestyle issues, as Dr. Mani said. We should be better at it. I think the conventional healer should be better at it.
I think a recent study showed that oncologists who know about the importance of psychosocial support and stress reduction and those types of issues for their patients often don't get to that conversation in an appointment because they're putting out fires. You know, you've got all of these problems related to your cancer and then to the treatments of the cancer, what's the next step, the next intervention going to be. It's not because they're not good people. So, people who do cancer treatment are some of the most caring people I know. They just never have a chance to get to it. And so we need to think about how we can enhance the current healthcare system and model so that we can have more supportive therapies.
Well, perfect way to end the hour. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Daniel Monti, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Paul Offit, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Paul Offit's new book is called Do You Believe in Magic? The Sense and Nonsense of Alternative Medicine. He's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and Daniel Monti, director of the Jefferson Myrna Bryn Center of Integrative Medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, where he's a professor in the departments of psychiatry and emergency medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Bilder, with Emily Hawes helping us out today. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.